Well, good afternoon, good morning, and happy Sabbath once again. They've come up with wireless everything else. You had headphones, right, with wires on them, and then got wireless headphones, and you come with a wireless mask, because every time I take one off, my glasses go fwing across the room. So I think I need to start wearing contacts again. I don't know. Anyway. Many moons ago, when I was a teenager and I was in college as well, a friend of mine introduced me to Monty Python's Flying Circus. Now, most of you are probably at least somewhat familiar with some Monty Python. It was British sketch comedy. They made a couple of movies, The Life of Brian and The Search for the Holy Grail. So some have seen that. But the real gold, in my opinion, was the actual television series that came out, I think, in 1969 on, I think it was on BBC4. Mr. Bronk can correct me on that, on this. They had four major TV stations, BBC 1, 2, 3, and 4. And 4 was kind of where all the weird, strange stuff, leftover things that couldn't quite make it onto prime television went. And so it was on BBC4, and they had all kinds of crazy skits. And some of it was a bit off color, but there was a lot of very humorous things in there. If you like British humor, British humor is a little bit different than what it is in the U.S. One of my favorites was called The Money Program, and it featured the main character in the sketch was Eric Idle. He's an actor who's done other things since then. You may have seen him in other movies. And the sketch starts out, "Today we'll be talking about money and lots of it." And then he starts describing all kinds of money, and he kind of gets obsessed with it. And he talks about the feel of the fiver and the clinking the metal together, and he just goes on and gets worked up, and finally he jumps onto the desk there, and he breaks out in the song, "I've got 90,000 pounds in my pajamas, I've got 40,000 French francs in my fridge." He starts singing about all this money, and he gets to the conclusion, "Oh, there is nothing quite as wonderful as money," and he's really obsessed with the money, and the whole thing just goes out of control from there. The fellow was obsessed with money in a very unhealthy sort of a way. I think we all understand that money should not be an obsession for us. It shouldn't be a god. But the reality is it's very important for us. It's something that's pretty much required to exist in society today. So the question becomes, how do we handle it? How do we handle it? Today, I want to look at some biblical principles for handling finances. I've come up with 7. I didn't intend to come up with 7 because, I understand 7 is the number of perfection. And I used to think ministers always try to come up with 7 points because of that. But I think the reality is you start coming up with points and thoughts and your brain kind of runs out of steam after about 6 or 7. So 7 is what we came up with, what I came up with today. You could probably come up with more. But I kind of broke it down into 7 different ones, and it makes it nice kind of bite-sized chunks we can look at. So we'll talk a little bit about money, what the Bible says about money in general, and then we'll start looking at some biblical principles for handling it. So we'll look at 7 biblical principles for handling finances. First thing I think we need to know and understand is that God is not opposed to having money. He is not opposed to us having some wealth, a little extra money in the bank. The challenge, as we know, is that money can't become a god for us. Let's begin with that principle in Matthew 6, verse 24. Matthew 6, verse 24. This is one you're probably familiar with. Matthew 6, 24. We're going to break into context here. Jesus giving teachings here, and one of the things that he says in verse 24, it says, "No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon." Other translations for mammon are riches or money or treasure. If money is so important to us that that's all we think about, like the fellow who broke into song on the skit does, then it's become a god. It's become a god. It could be the same way for anything. We've talked about people who have addictions to alcohol, pornography, whatever it is. It's all they think about. It begins to rule and run their lives. And Christ says, you know, we can't let money be that force. It can't be our god. If we spend every last breath, chasing the almighty dollar, then we have no time left for Bible study, for prayer, for family. Over in 1 Timothy 6, we see another well-known, but often misunderstood and misquoted teaching about money. 1 Timothy 6, starting in verse 9. 1 Timothy 6, verse 9, it says, "But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and a snare, and in many foolish and harmful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition." So again, this is talking about someone whose desire, their driving desire in life, is to get rich. Again, there's nothing wrong with having a few extra shekels in the bank. There's nothing wrong with making good money. But it shouldn't be what makes us live. It shouldn't be why we get out of bed in the morning. It says, "For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil, for which some have strayed from the faith in their greediness and pierced themselves through with many sorrows." Many misquote this verse and says, the love of money is the root of all evil. You see that on posted, on signs and all that. But that's not what it actually says. It says, "For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil." Now, there is some where it says kinds of, and some of your translations that may be inserted in there. But the part where it says it is a root is there. That's in the original Greek. Okay, it is a root. It can be an issue. It's not the sole root of all evil. Cain and Abel, before they even had money, there was evil there, right? Cain had jealousy. He killed his brother. Lots of people have been killed, murdered over many other things besides money. But the point is, we can't let this drive our lives. We can't let money be this god. Now, that being said, money, again, is not a bad thing. God worked with Abraham, who was quite wealthy. Let's just look at Abraham's life for just a moment. Genesis, let's go to Genesis 13, verse 1, just to establish this point quickly. Genesis 13, verse 1, it says, "Then Abram went up from Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, and Lot with him to the south. Abram was very rich in livestock, in silver, and in gold." We're not told exactly how wealthy he was, but it says he was very rich, and he's actually listed in three different commodities. This would be like somebody owning, having investments in gold, oil, and technology. He didn't just have an extra little bit of money in the bank. This guy was heavily invested in, renewable energy, in real estate, in agriculture, whatever you want to say it. He was very wealthy. We're told a little bit about the state of his finances when Sarah dies in Genesis 23. Genesis 23, you may recall the story. There's a kind of a big scene here where he buys the field to bury Sarah, and he doesn't argue about the price because he wants there to be no doubt about whether he purchased the field, whether it was a clean transaction or not. But we're told what he purchased it for in Genesis 23, verse 14. Genesis 23, verse 14, says, "And Ephraim answered Abraham, saying to him, 'My Lord, listen to me. The land is worth 400 shekels of silver. What is that between you and me? So bury your dead.' And Abraham listened to Ephraim, and Abraham weighed out the silver for Ephraim, which he had named in the hearing of the sons of Heth, 400 shekels of silver, currency of the merchants." So there's a little bit of debate on exactly how much a shekel was worth, but most commentaries say that 10 shekels was a year's wage. He paid 400 shekels. He paid 40 years worth of wages for this. I don't care how much you make or how little you make. That's a lot of money. When I went to buy an engagement ring for my wife, the salesman tried to tell me 2 to 3 months' salary. My dad said, "You know, son, 2 weeks is just fine." I took dad's advice. 40 years is a lot of salary. You could buy a lot more than an engagement. You can buy a house. You buy a couple houses for 40 years' salary for most people. The point is, Abraham had that money to spend. Abraham was not poor and destitute. Abraham had quite a bit of money. Again, the concept that money isn't a bad thing is pointed out over and over in the Bible. Proverbs 10. Let's look here. Proverbs 10. Proverbs 10, verse 4, it says, "He who is a slack hand becomes poor, but the hand of the diligent makes rich. He who gathers in summer is a wise son. He who sleeps in harvest is a son who causes shame." Now, another misconception we must fight against is that it's not shameful to be poor. Right? It says if you don't work to support yourself, and we'll see that concept later, that's something, you know, to be shamed over. But if you don't have a lot of money, you know, that's not a sin either, okay? But the Bible does teach us what we can do in order to become more financially secure, and that's the focus of our message today. 2 Chronicles chapter 1. There's one more thought here on having money, and that, you know, having wealth is not a sin. But again, neither is being poor. Being poor is not a sin. It might make your life a little more challenging, and so the focus of this message is to help us all out to deal with challenges. You've heard it said that money doesn't solve all your problems, but it does give you options, and there's a lot of truth in that. There's a lot of truth in that. 2 Chronicles 1, verse 11, God said to Solomon, "Because this was in your heart, and you have not asked riches or wealth or honor or the life of your enemies," you know, God said, "Solomon, what do you want?" And Solomon said, "Give me wisdom." So God answers him and says, "Because you haven't asked for these things, nor have you asked for long life, but you've asked for wisdom and knowledge for yourself, that you may judge my people over whom I have made you king," points out to the fact that Solomon's effort and intention was to serve God and his people. Solomon's effort and intention wasn't to get rich. It was to serve God and his people. He said, but because that's what you want to do, he says, "Wisdom and knowledge are granted to you, and I will give you riches and wealth and honor, such as none of the kings who have had who were before you, nor shall any after you have the like." So God wanted to bless Solomon with riches, and he did. And he did. So money itself is not evil. What about God? What's his house look like? Does he live in a, you know, two-room shack with dirt floors? No, he doesn't. We're actually given a description of what the New Jerusalem, what the kingdom will be like. Let's just take a quick glance at that. Revelation 21. Revelation 21. Verse 18. So here we see actually the new heaven, new earth, the new Jerusalem, and we're getting a description of the new Jerusalem here. Revelation 21, verse 18, it says, "The construction of its wall was of jasper, and the city was pure gold like clear glass." Read some commentaries on that, and basically what that refers to, that most Bible scholars believe, is the sheen or the shine or the luster. If you've ever seen gold in its raw form, you know, it's this raw nugget. It's not necessarily very shiny. It's pretty dirty. But, you know, you see it in the refined state, which is where you might, you know, wear it for a ring or a piece of jewelry. It's very fine. It's very polished. A lot of that is because we have the mechanical means to do that. Back in the day here, gold probably didn't have the high luster of the gold that you see today. You saw was stuff that was hand-polished, and for anything to be that shiny was really amazing. And so the writer here in Revelation is pointing to this is going to be extremely fine, well-polished gold. What you and I see today by comparison is probably 10 times, you know, shinier, more dazzling than the gold that they would have touched and seen in biblical times. But here, of course, he's looking to the future. He's looking to the kingdom. Says it's a pure gold. Said the foundations of the wall of the city were adorned with all kinds of precious stones. And I won't go in and read all the stones for sake of time. But in verse 21, it says the 12 gates were of 12 pearls. Each individual gate was one pearl, and the street of the city was pure gold, like transparent glass. You know, if God thought that money and gold and riches were sinful, he'd be awful hypocritical to say, you know, I'm going to make the New Jerusalem out of all that stuff. So I think the point that we can see then, the first principle to consider, is that money is not evil or sinful, whether you have a lot of it or whether you have a little of it. Money is not evil or sinful, but an improper love of it is. And that's our first biblical principle. Money is a necessary part of our lives. There is nothing wrong with having a little extra, nor is it a sin if you don't have a life, although it can make, or if you, excuse me, nor is it a sin if you don't have a lot of money, although it can make life a little more challenging. But in either case, whether we have a little or we have a lot, we can't make a god of money. Starting with the second principle, we'll start getting into talking about what to do with what money we do have, whether we have a little or whether we have a lot. Like all things in life, we must learn to prioritize. And like all things in life, our first priority must be with God. I think we all understand the biblical principle of tithing. I'm not going to go into an exhaustive message on tithing. We covered that in a Bible study last year. Actually, in February of this year, I gave a sermon entitled, Why Tithe? That was on February 22nd of this year. So if you want to go back on the webcast, on the local website, you can hear that sermon. But just to recap a little bit why we tithe, we do it, of course, to honor God. We do it because it's God's money in the first place. We do it to see, we do it for our own benefit, so we begin to learn to manage money, and we tithe so we can learn the value of money. So I won't go into the commands for tithe again. We covered it in those two sermons, but we understand that tithing needs to be our priority with our money while we have it. First, we need to pay that tithe, whatever we, you know, have after taxes and whatnot. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. So understanding that tithing is a priority. Tithing isn't something that we do if we have enough money left over. But understanding that tithing is a priority, what else is a priority? What else is a priority? There's an example given in Proverbs 6 that I think most of us are familiar with. Proverbs 6, verse 6. Further, Proverbs 6, verse 6. You may keep a marker or a finger here in Proverbs. We'll be coming back to Proverbs quite a bit. Basically, if you want to know how to manage your money, read Proverbs. Proverbs has a lot of very, very sound biblical advice in it, and we'll be reading quite a few of those things today. Proverbs 6, verse 6 says, "Go to the ant, you sluggard." I don't want to be called a sluggard. It makes me think of that little slimy thing that crawls around in my garden and moves real slow. That's basically what it's describing. It says, "Go to the ant, you sluggard." You know, you see a little ant always scurrying around, moving about, doing something. You don't ever see ants just sitting still, right? It says, "Consider her ways and be wise, which, having no captain, overseer, or ruler, provides her supplies in the summer and gathers her food in the harvest. How long will you slumber, O sluggard? When will you rise from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep." Just going to sit back, take a little snoozy snooze, you know, let life pass me by. It says, "So shall your poverty come on you like a prowler, and your need like an armed man." And so again, pointing to, it's not a sin not to have a lot of money, but it does make life difficult, make some aspects of life difficult. The animal kingdom doesn't use currency like you and I do. Slugs and ants don't exchange dollar bills. They don't have PayPal. They don't use Venmo or Apple Pay, right? But they know a few things about food and shelter, don't they? They know that those are a priority. Why? Because it's a priority for self-preservation. Here we see the ant going out, being diligently working hard to get the supplies it needs for food and shelter. And of course, it's not just old numero uno we need to think about when it comes to providing, is it? 1 Timothy chapter 5, 1 Timothy chapter 5, Paul here is addressing an issue and taking care of widows and some who were not really widows, but basically taking advantage of kindness. But he points this out. 1 Timothy 5, verse 8, he says, if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. And we understand then it's not just us. You know, we have members of our family, our spouse, our children, you know, our parents at some point in time. If we bring children into the world, you know, we need to be able to take care of them financially speaking. If we have aging parents, you know, we may need to help them out, whether that's, you know, physically helping them or whether it's helping them, you know, make plans for their finances, doing estate planning, whatever it might be. We have that responsibility. You know, maybe that's not in your wheelhouse. Maybe finances aren't your thing. And maybe, you know, you need to contact a lawyer, do whatever it is you need to do. But we have a responsibility to take care of those in our own household, our own family, whether it's our children, whether it's our parents, grandparents, whatever it might be. Let's notice another teaching back in Proverbs. Proverbs 20. Proverbs verse chapter 20. Proverbs 20, verse 13, it says, do not love sleep, lest you come to poverty. Open your eyes, and you shall be satisfied with bread. Points back to that, you know, that slug and the ant, right? You know, sitting back and watching, you know, life pass by. There's a time to make hay, as they say. You know, if you have the ability to work, we need to do so, so that as you get older, you can enjoy retirement and whatnot. Chapter 21, verse 5 says, the plans of the diligent lead surely to plenty, but those of everyone who is hasty, surely to poverty. And one more here in chapter 21, verse 20, it says, there is desirable treasure and oil in the dwelling of the wise, but a foolish man squanders it. This is said to be the origin of the phrase, a fool and his money are soon parted. Proverbs 21, verse 20. A fool and his money are soon parted. I think that's one we've probably all heard, but Proverbs 21, verse 20 is, again, said to be the origin of that. This points to a second principle of biblical finances. We need to prioritize our finances. We need to prioritize them, and we need to make finances in general a priority. It can't just be something we keep ignoring. It's one of those things, you know, a problem ignored does not go away. That's certainly true in finances. It usually just gets worse. So we need to prioritize our finances. We need to take care of necessities like food and shelter. We need to keep the kids in shoes. We need to have, you know, basic transportation, et cetera, like things like that. And only after those things are taken care of can we begin to think about all those wants. We spoke a few weeks ago about wants and needs. You know, take care, make sure the things you have, then, you know, you can start thinking about those, you know, cute shoes you want, or the supercharger for your Mustang, or whatever it is, you know, your personal vice might be. So we need to prioritize our finances. That's our second principle. The next obvious question is, okay, so how do I know what my priorities are? How do I know what my priorities are? Let's go just over a couple more chapters in Proverbs 24. Now, I know I need to prioritize my money, but how exactly do I do that? In Proverbs 24, verse 27. says, prepare your outside work, make it fit for yourself in the field, and afterward, build your harvest. Now, there's a sense of getting your priorities right here and starting to plan things out. You got a building project, okay, you know, now I got to get this field ready so I can even start, and then I can start to build. Proverbs 27, verse 23, starting verse 23, this was our memory scripture. Proverbs 27, verse 23, says, be diligent to know the state of your flocks and attend to your herds, for riches are not forever, nor does a crown endure to all generations. When the hay is removed and the tender grass shows itself and the herbs of the mountain are gathered in, the lambs will provide your clothing and the goats the price of a field. No seasons change for a farmer, right? There's a time to sow, there's a time to reap, there's a time to fatten up the sheep, there's a time to shear the sheep, there's a time, you know, to slaughter, to sell them. It says, the lambs will provide your clothing, the goats the price of a field. You shall have enough goat's milk for your food, for the food of your household, and for the nourishment of your maidservants. Now, being able to take care of all those in your household, even those that you have hired. The Bible says, be diligent to know the state of your flocks. This reminds me of an old saying in manufacturing, which was, you can't fix what you can't measure. You can't fix what you can't measure. So an example in manufacturing might be you're making a product. And most products, you know, have some sort of a test that happens before it gets put on the shelf, before a customer could buy it, just to make sure the quality is good. You know, it's a kind of quality control in place. Every now and again, we'd come across a product that wasn't performing. It didn't work the way it was supposed to, for whatever reason. Well, what would we do? We'd start looking at the process, and there's a lot of different ways to do that. But eventually, at some point in time, we usually found ourselves taking that product apart and taking measurements. You know, it might be a length, it might be a thickness, it might be a hole size, something along that lines. We had to figure out if all the parts were intolerances to see, you know, is this the problem? There had to be something to measure against. There had to be a known good. Okay, this dimension on this part makes this product work this way. There had to be something that we knew, and more often than not, we'd come and find out, oh, wait, this product isn't working because this dimension is out of spec. But, you know, if we never knew what to measure, then we couldn't start tracing down how to fix the problem. With finances, it's often the same way. You know, if we find we're constantly, as the old saying goes, there's too much month at the end of the money, then we got to figure out, well, why is that? We have to be able to measure our money. How do you do that? Well, the answer, as you may have already guessed, is what is known the world over as a budget. A budget. I've referred today quite a bit, and I recommend, this is the UCG booklet, Managing Your Finances. I think this is a little older copy. I think the color cover may have changed somewhere along the lines. A lot of good principles in here. And I'm right in the middle of it, and I want to maybe put this a little bit closer. You can see this on the screen for those on the webcast. There is a budget. Now, you can look online. You can find hundreds of different types of budgets, and most of them are pretty similar. Here's one, again, the church has provided through this booklet. I've made copies of this, and they're back there on the information table for anyone who would like to take a look at one a little bit closer. In it, you see some basic things, What is my take-home pay? I worked with a guy once upon a time who he really didn't even know what his pay was. He just didn't pay attention. He bought the stuff he needed, and at the end of the month, he just zeroed everything out in his checkbook. And most of the time that worked out pretty good for him because, you know, to his credit, he was fairly frugal. He wasn't spending money on a lot of things wildly. And so he kept zeroing out his money. Well, all that money that was actually still left in the bank account, when he finally went to look at it, he had a nice little savings in there. But he was playing a dangerous game there because he didn't know what he really had to work with. What is your take-home pay? What is it after you pay your tithes? How much do you spend on rent? What about your utilities? One of the fantastic things that's come along in the past, I guess, 10 years, is that most utility companies have what they call even pay or even billing. I remember my first house, was up in Ohio. We had electric heat. We bought it in the summer. And so we were just paying for the electric we use, you know, to run fans or even the air conditioner, which we weren't running as much. And so it was about $100 a month. February, I got a $450 electric bill, and I about died. March was about $500. What they were able to do was switch me over to what's called even billing, where basically they take and they average out, you know, how much this is what you spend in a year divided by 12. And so you pay evenly. So sometimes, you know, your bill might be $100, but you're paying $200. So you're basically building yourself up a credit. So it's not that shock of that $450, $500 electric bill. What are your bills? How much do you actually spend on clothes? How much do you actually spend on food? Do you go to the store, buy what you need or want, and then come back and see how much money you have left? Or do you go to the store and say, this is how much money I have to spend on this? You know, what can I afford to buy, right? What about recreation? One of the handy things about the particular budget and that's in the booklet, and that's there on the information table if you like, it gives what is maybe a suggested percentage rate. So you start looking up at that, and for most people, you know, your housing is probably going to be the largest portion of that, right? But it gives you an idea that this is maybe a good amount to look at. And if you look at, you know, your food budget and it says, okay, I'm spending 35% of my income on food, and you know, most people spend somewhere around 15 to 20%, you might say, wow, I'm spending a lot of money on food. This is a place that I can start to go and look at things. This particular worksheet then gives you a way to add things up, and then you get to the final, and you can look at how much you're actually spending versus what you're making, and you can see are you in the red, you know, a negative, or are you in the black, a positive? And then you can start looking at things. Wow, you know, hey, I've got a little extra money than I thought. Maybe I can start putting some of this aside. Or, you know, you can look at it and say, oh, no wonder why I can't pay all my bills. I don't have enough, you know, money for this. But you can't fix what you can't measure. And so a budget is a great way for us to be able to do that. The way my mom put it was this: take care of the nickels and dimes, and the dollars will take care of themselves. Now, basically, balancing her checkbook was you know, more or less a daily thing for mom. We may not have had a lot of money, but she knew exactly to the penny what we had. And basically, by knowing what exactly we had to spend, then she made sure we never ran out of anything. You know, you might not have a lot of money, right? But if you track that, if you keep a close eye on it, you can avoid getting yourself into financial trouble and you can better figure how to get out of it. So keeping track of it is a key thing. And one last scripture on this point. This is from Jesus Christ in Luke chapter 14. Luke chapter 14. Christ is speaking here about counting the cost to be a disciple, and that is the major teaching of this point. But he gives an analogy, one that's certainly applicable to finances. Luke 14, verse 28 says, "For which of you can, excuse me, for which of you intending to build a tower does not sit down first and count the cost, whether he has enough to finish it? Left at less after he had laid the foundation is not able to finish, and all who see it begin to mock him, saying, 'This man began to build and was not able to finish.'" Well, you know, put aside the part that people might laugh at us, But I mean, think about that. We say, well, you know, I'm going to build a house. And so I'm going to, you know, buy the land. And I'm going to clear the foundations. And I'm going to get the foundation poured. And I got the floor built. And I got one wall. And oh, wait, now I ran out of money. I remember seeing a house like this when I was a kid. There was somebody who went to do a rebuild project. And I don't know the whole story, but it seems like they ran out. And basically, it just sat there with, you know, one or two walls up. And it got rained on and eventually rotted and all collapsed on itself. You know, was a living example of that. Our third biblical principle is this: not just prioritizing, but planning our finances. We should plan our finances. An important part of this principle is counting the cost. And the best way to do that is begin by creating a budget. Again, there's a worksheet on the information table for you to look at. Don't be afraid to look at that budget. Don't be afraid to go through and fill in those numbers, not knowing exactly what the end result looks like. Don't be surprised if you put, okay, here's what my income is, and here's what I spend on food, and this is what I spend on clothes, and this is what I spend on entertainment. And at the end of it, you say, uh-oh, these numbers are backwards. Don't be surprised. Don't let that stop you. But you have to start somewhere. You have to start somewhere, and by measuring that, planning our finances, you can go ahead and begin to get a start on getting a handle on financial security. The next biblical principle when it comes to handling our finances shows that we need to consider more than just our immediate needs, more than just food, rent, gas in the car. We need to think a little more long term. Let's turn back to Genesis 41. Genesis chapter 41. Genesis 41, we read about Pharaoh's dream, and he dreamed about the seven fat cows and the seven skinny cows that came up and ate them. And so Joseph is asked to interpret it. Joseph does and lets Pharaoh know that there's a famine coming. But notice what happens then. He doesn't just say, a famine's coming, everybody run and hide and panic. He says, a famine is coming, so what are we going to do about it? Verse 33, it says, now therefore, let Pharaoh select a discerning and wise man and let him set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh do this and let him appoint officers over the land to collect one-fifth of the produce of the land of Egypt in the seven plentiful years, and let them gather all the food in those good years that are coming and store up grain under the authority of Pharaoh, and let them keep food in the cities. Then that food shall be as a reserve for the land for the 7 years of famine which shall be in the land of Egypt, that the land may not perish during the famine. Pharaoh, Joseph, they had the luxury of knowing that an emergency was coming. They made a plan to save for that. You and I probably don't have the luxury of knowing when our next financial emergency is coming. But I think most of us have been around long enough to know that it is coming, one way or the other. And because of that, we can plan for the future. This is from DaveRamsey.com. This is not a wholesale endorsement of Dave Ramsey, but he does give some good financial advice. He uses biblical principles. This is an excerpt from his website. It says, according to the Federal Reserve, 39% of Americans don't have the cash on hand to cover a $400 emergency. You know, car won't start, you know, need a new battery, got to get towed. Maybe you get a flat, you got to get tires. A refrigerator, you know, dies. All those things can be $400 pretty quickly in an instant. It says, and more than half of households couldn't live without their income for just 1 month. If you got no more money, could you live 30 days on the money you have in the bank? It says more than half households couldn't do that. He says, yikes. He says, lots of Americans definitely prioritize the present over the future. Here he quotes Proverbs 21, verse 20, as we already read that, but he reads it from the NIV. He says, Proverbs 21, verse 20 explains the value in saving for a rainy day. And the house of the wise are stores of choice food and oil, but a foolish man devours all he has. And even beyond your own household, savings can create financial stability for future generations. Quotes Proverbs 13, verse 22 from the New King James. Here he says, a good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children. Here we see two good reasons to save for the future. One is for emergency situation. You know, cars won't start. Appliances go bad. Layoffs happen at work. Have you ever noticed that when you get a little bit of money set aside, there's always something that comes up to take it? Always something, right? Having a little set aside in an emergency fund is a good idea. I would suggest actually keeping a little bit of cash on you is also a good idea. Keeping a little cash on your person. I'm not saying walk around with your life savings in your back pocket, but keeping a little bit of cash on you is a good idea. That's the principle my dad taught me. He said always, you know, keep an extra 20 bucks stuffed in your wallet. He said you never know when you're going to need it. I was driving through the country one time. This was, you know, I was 19, 20 years old. This is before everybody had pay at the pump, right? And I was getting low on gas and just, you know, I was out in the country and came across this one little corner gas station. And guess what? I was out of gas and they didn't take credit cards. fortunately, I had 20 bucks. And I could, you know, back then I could fill my tank for 20 bucks. I could fill my tank and I was able to take care of that need. So we should save for an emergency. Dave Ramsey here just throws out the figure of $400, and we'll get into a little more specifics on that later on. But I would suggest it's also probably a good idea to keep a little bit of cash on your person, on your wallet, in your purse, just for when things may come up. The second reason for having a savings, having planning for the future, or the second reason to plan for the future, is to give economic security to others. Many of you have children or grandchildren even. I just realized I have an adult child now. yeah, but you have family to take care of. A day will come when, you know, we're no longer around. You've worked hard to amass whatever you have, maybe a little, maybe a lot. You want to make sure that you're able to pass that blessing on to them, as Dave Ramsey mentioned there, Proverbs 13. Along with not just having that money to pass on, you want to make sure that that money actually gets passed on. Here's where I get to the point where I say, if you don't have a financial plan for your estate, it is a good idea to have one. There are many institutions out there that can help you do that. Your bank can probably help you do that. There are lawyers set up that do estate planning. There's also a program, I'll just take a moment to mention it, that the church has called Planned Giving. If you desire to have a certain portion of your estate go to the church after you pass, you can do so. If you go to UCG's website, which is www.ucg.org, it's one of two ways you can do it. In the search bar, you can just type in planned giving, or you can click on the upper, your upper left, the upper left of your screen, there's a button there that says donate. If you click on that, it'll have all kinds of different things that show, you know, you can make a donation to different funds. There's also one there that says planned giving. If you click on that, it'll give you a number, an email that you can call, and you can begin to look at that. Our fourth biblical principle when it comes to your finances is that we should consider the future with our finances. We should consider the future with our finances. Not only should we think about having some money set aside for emergencies, we should work to have an inheritance for our children or for other charities. So our fourth principle is we should consider the future for our finances. So we talked about planning. Our last step, that was more planning for the immediate needs. This is more planning for long term. We talked about leaving it to our children here in the future. But what else does the Bible say about our finances and others? we don't want to enable bad behavior. I worked with a fellow many years ago who told me the story of his family. His father was an alcoholic. His mother was what's known as the primary enabler, and I'd never heard that term until he explained it to me. Basically, his mom enabled his father to be an alcoholic. He would go to the bar, you know, and get drunk, you know, just about every night. She is the one who handled the finances. She would give him the money. He'd get too drunk to drive home. She'd go and pick him up. She was enabling bad behavior. Financially speaking, we don't want to enable bad behavior. We don't want to, you know, if people who are unwilling to work, who can support themselves, but they don't want to, we don't want to enable that. But there is a time and place to help those who have legitimate financial needs. Let's turn back to Leviticus chapter 25. Leviticus 25. Let's pick it up verse 35. Leviticus 25, verse 35. Leviticus 25, verse 35. It says, "If one of your brethren becomes poor and falls into poverty among you, then you shall help him like a stranger or a sojourner that he may live with you." Okay? It says if he becomes poor, again, a reminder that being poor, if you don't have a lot of money, that's not a sin. Okay? It presents challenges, right? But it's not a sin. It says if one of your brethren becomes poor, falls into poverty, you shall help him like a stranger or a sojourner that he might live with you. Take no usury or interest from him. In other words, we don't loan shark. We don't charge him interest if we need to help him out a little bit. But fear your God that your brother may live with you. You shall not lend him your money for usury, nor lend him your food at a profit. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan and to be your God. People fall on hard times. God points out to Israel, he said, remember when you were in slavery for 400 years in Egypt? You were kind of on hard times there. I brought you out. I helped you out when you really couldn't help yourselves. God says we should do that for others as well. We see this laid out in the New Testament as well, 1 Corinthians 16. This wasn't just an Old Testament principle. This is something we see being actively done. 1 Corinthians 16. I'm very familiar with 1 Corinthians 15. 1 Corinthians in general, we understand, is a book where Paul was dealing a lot with issues of division. 1 Corinthians 15 talks about the resurrection. 1 Corinthians 16 kind of gets into taking care of some of the business at hand. You might consider that if this whole Book of Corinthians was Sabbath services, 1 Corinthians 16 is kind of the announcements for what's going on here locally. 1 Corinthians 16, he said, "Now concerning the collection for the saints, I have given you orders to the churches of Galatia, so you must do also. On the first day of the week, let each of you lay something aside, storing up as he may prosper, that there be no collections when I come." Some try to twist this scripture, by the way, that say, well, see, Paul said you go to church on the first day of the week. That's not what he said. In fact, he's pointing to the fact that I don't want you to do this at church services. Do it on the first day of the week. Do it at another time. We're going to lay aside a little bit to help these people out. It says, "And when I come, whomever you approve by your letters, I will send to bear your gift to Jerusalem." Now, if you read over in Romans 15 and Acts 11, most biblical commentators will point to the fact there was a famine going on down in the region of Judea. So in other areas up in Corinth, Europe, where those churches were, there wasn't a famine. They were able to collect some food. They were sending it down to those in Judea to help out. That's what Paul is talking about here. You might recall a few years ago when there was an issue where they were starting a church down, I believe it was in Haiti. I remember that, and there was an announcement went out and said, hey, we can use some help doing some things. We need, basics, clothes, food, shelter. Money really didn't do a lot of good at that point in time for them because there wasn't stuff to buy. They actually needed goods. If you recall, what we did here locally is we collected some money. We bought, I think, like 400 pairs of flip-flops or something like that, and we were able to stick it into a shipping container that was going on down to Haiti along with several other donations that were going someplace. The point is, God expects us to help out the poor. God expects us to help out the poor, especially our brothers and sisters in Christ. You know, Galatians 6:10 reminds us to do good to all men, especially those of the household of faith. God expects us to help out the poor. Ephesians 4, verse 28. Ephesians 4, verse 28 says, "Let him who stole steal no longer, but rather let him labor, working with his hands what is good, that he may have something to give to him who has need." Now, we see two principles being pointed out here. One, if we can work to support ourselves, we should do that. Actually, three principles. One is, if you used to steal, don't steal anymore. Come out of sinful behavior. The second principle is that if you can work to support yourself, do so. And the third principle is, set something aside so you can help other people. Our fifth biblical principle, then, is we should consider others with our finances. We should consider others with our finances. God provided for Israel when they had no place to go. I'm sure every single one of us can provide stories, can tell stories of how someone, somewhere along the line, provided for us when we couldn't help ourselves out. You and I should be considering others with our finances so that we can help them when they find themselves in a state of need. To this point, we've talked about what it is we should do with our money, how it's a blessing, how we can take care of it, how we can help others out, how to plan for the future, how to prioritize. But what if we find ourselves in a state where we need help, where we need money? We are without money, or worse, we're in crippling debt. Let's glean a couple principles quickly from Proverbs again on this. Proverbs 22. Proverbs 22, verse 7 says, "The rich rules over the poor, and the borrower is servant to the lender." Now, we don't want to find ourselves in a place of financial slavery. Now, that's not to say we can never take a loan. Very few people are going to be able to save enough cash to go out and, you know, buy a house or even buy a car. But we don't want to live in financial slavery. We don't want to get to the point where all of our money is only used to just pay off past debts. If we're in trouble, clearly this isn't a place we want to be, and we want to work to get out of it. Proverbs 6, we read Proverbs 6 starting in verse 6. Let's back up and read the rest of the chapter, Proverbs 6. Well, not all the rest of the chapter, but the first part of it. Proverbs 6 and verse 1. Proverbs 6 and verse 1. It says, "My son, if you become his surety for your friend," this is basically a co-signer on a loan. "If you have shaken hands and pledge for a stranger," you know, you're helping somebody out by co-signing on a loan. Now, I understand there's a time and place in order to co-sign on a loan. You know, if you got, you know, children and they're first starting out and they're trying to take out a loan to buy that first car and they don't have the credit, you want to help them out. There's appropriate time and place. But you want to be careful about what you're co-signing too. I remember a story that my dad told. He co-signed on a loan for his younger brother, for which their father, my grandfather, about wrung my dad's neck because it wasn't for something that was a necessity. It was for a Les Paul guitar, if I remember right, which I think it was like $400 back in 1958. That guitar today is worth somewhere around $25,000, $30,000. My uncle sold it in the late 70s for about $8,000. So in terms of investment, it was a good investment. But the principle was, my grandfather said, you know, to my dad, "Charles, why did you take a cosign on this loan for this frivolous thing? You know. So the point here is we don't want to do this on frivolous things. There are going to be times when, particularly as a parent, you might want to help out a child. Certainly as husband and wife, you know, you co-sign on a loan together, things like that. But we're talking about, you know, a foolish act of loaning your money to someone else here. It says, you're snared by the words of your mouth. You're taken in the words of your mouth. So do this, my son, and deliver yourself. For you have come into the hand of your friend. Go and humble yourself. Plead with your friend. Give no sleep to your eyes, nor slumber to your eyelids. Deliver yourself like a gazelle from the hand of the hunter, like a bird from the hand of the fowler. The advice here is simple. If you find yourself in a bad financial deal, you need to work to get out of it. Now, I'm not saying, you know, welch on your debt, don't pay off your loans. But I am pointing to the fact that some financial deals are better than others. And this kind of points back to looking at what the interest rates are if we take a loan, making sure that we don't put more on our credit card than what we can actually pay for. But if you do get yourself into that situation, we should work to try to remedy it. We should work to try to make it less financially painful. If we go back just to couple of chapters in Proverbs 4. Proverbs 4, verse 5, we see some advice given by Solomon. It says, get wisdom, get understanding. Do not forget nor turn away from the words of your mouth. This is Proverbs 4, verse 5. It says, do not forsake her. So it's personifying wisdom as a woman here. It says, do not forsake her and she will preserve you. Love her and she will keep you. Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom. And in all you're getting, get understanding. Now, we often think about this scripture in terms of biblical understanding. And certainly that is the most important thing. We need to get biblical wisdom so we understand how to live our lives. You know, that's not just limited to spiritual matters. No, we can get financial wisdom as well. Now, I don't give out financial advice other than if you find yourself in need of financial advice, go get good financial advice. Go to someone who's qualified. Most any bank that you might bank at can give you some advice. If you have debt, if you have a credit card debt, talk to the credit card company themselves. They can often begin to start to work deals with you. You know, from their perspective, it's a lot better for you to pay a little than to pay nothing at all, right? Get wisdom. Get wisdom. Seek financial advice. Seek financial counseling. Now, I will also say be very careful as you do so. Do look for a qualified source. You know, if you go out on the internet and say, I need financial help, you're liable to find all sorts of people who are just going to take more of your money. So be very wise in vetting that advice you get. Again, I would recommend you start perhaps with your local financial institution and they can point you in the right way. But the point is this. The point is this. If we find ourselves in bad financial situation, we should work to remove ourselves from it. Don't be content just to stay in debt. If we're having financial difficulty, we need to work to get out of it. Don't ignore it. It will not go away. And while I do not give financial advice, if you do need help with this, please let me know and I will help you find the right financial advice that you need. We looked at six principles. We'll conclude today with a seventh principle. A seventh principle that's more of a plan, an action item list. This one comes, again, directly from UCG's booklet here, Managing Your Finances. And in fact, this booklet, the part that I'm going to quote, is actually quoting from Dave Ramsey once again here. Takes this tip from him. It says, after paying the tithes and necessary living expenses, we need to decide what to do with the remainder of our money. While financial counselors each have slightly different recommendations, well-known financial advisor Dave Ramsey teaches that people can obtain financial peace. And think about that for a minute. Isn't that what you want? And we talked about having a lot of money. We talked about having a little money. What you really want is peace, right? And if your finances are out of whack, it's hard to get that peace. It's hard to have that peace of mind. Dave Ramsey teaches that people can obtain financial peace through a sequence of actions referred to as seven baby steps. I know some of you have probably taken the Dave Ramsey course or have read his books, so you're going to be familiar with these. It says, refers to the seven baby steps of financial success. These steps are, and I'm going to read through these once, and I'll repeat them. Again, one, build a $1,000 emergency fund. And talked about, you know, a while ago how 39% of Americans can't cover a $400 emergency fund. He says, build a $1,000 emergency fund. Pay off all debt except one's home mortgage. I'm talking about credit cards, personal loans, whatever. Finish saving an emergency fund that will cover 3 to 6 months of expenses. All right, this gets back to planning your finances, going over a budget. What exactly are your expenses? If you didn't have any income, how much money would you have in the bank to live for the next 3 to 6 months? Step four, invest 15% of household income for retirement. Step five, save money for your children to attend college. Step six, pay off your home mortgage. And step seven, build wealth through investing and give like you never have before. Ramsey advises that only when each step is fully done should a person go on to the next step. So I'll review those seven steps again quickly. Number one, build a $1,000 emergency fund. Number two, pay off all debt except one's home mortgage. Number three, finish saving an emergency fund that will cover 3 to 6 months of expenses. That might be $5,000 for you. It might be $10,000 for you. Number four, invest 15% of household income for retirement. Number five, save money for your children to attend college. Number six, pay off your home mortgage. And number seven, build wealth through investing and give like you never have before. Again, it says make sure you get each step done before you go on to the next. Our seventh biblical principle, then, when it comes to our finances is simply this. Take action. Take action. Don't sit around and wait for the problem to go away. It won't. It will only get worse. Put another way, take control of your finances, or your finances will take control of you. Goes back to what we read about being a slave to the lender. Take action to understand and control your finances. Money, as they say, makes the world go around. We shouldn't love it, but the reality is all of us need it in some form or fashion in order to exist. With a proper perspective on money and applying sound biblical finances, you can have financial peace and security.